Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. Galen Druk is still on vacation, so you are stuck with me, Chadwick Matlin. I'm a deputy editor at 538, and we are back to discuss the last 48 hours of impeachment developments, because there have been so many. With me in the studio to discuss, it's senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Chad. What a treat to have my editor here.
And Claire's old editor, Micah Cohen, our managing editor, to her right. Hi, Micah.
Hello.
I'm literally in the middle of my two, as I was saying to Chad before, my once and current editor.
We'll edit what you say on this podcast in real time.
But very differently.
That'll be pleasant. Yeah, but we'll have differing opinions.
So on today's show, we're going to discuss what was important in the whistleblower's complaint against President Trump in Trump's dealings with the Ukrainian president. And we're going to talk about what the congressional hearing with Acting Director of National Intelligence Joseph McGuire told us about how this impeachment hearing might go. Those are just two of the events of the last 48 hours, but let's also recap the rest of it. So, deep breath. You guys last recorded a podcast on Tuesday evening after Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, said that she was opening officially an inquiry of impeachment into President Trump. Then on Wednesday morning, the White House declassified a summary of Trump's call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. That summary confirmed reporting that Trump pressured Zelensky to look into the Bidens while also mentioning U.S. aid to Ukraine. And that's what got us all into this week, let's not forget, was the report that this call had happened and there was that pressure. Then, on Thursday morning, which is today, we're recording this Thursday afternoon, the House Intelligence Committee released the whistleblower's complaint that started all this, and the subsequent report from the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, which looked into the whistleblower's complaint, and there were allegations in that complaint, and all of them are secondhand. The whistleblower, him or herself, I believe we still just do not know the gender, is sort of collecting information from within the administration, essentially. And we'll get to potentially who that whistleblower might be later in the show. And based on talking to people within the administration, the complaint alleges that Rudy Giuliani, as well as diplomats, followed up on that call that we now have the summary of. Ukrainian leadership believed that a call with Trump was contingent on being willing to, quote, play ball on Giuliani's requests for investigations, that there being sort of the subtext that they had to at least look into Biden if they wanted a continuation of aid. And then the complaint also alleges that, quote, senior White House officials had intervened to lock down all records of the phone call, especially the official word-for-word transcript of the call that was produced. And that White House lawyers directed staff to remove the transcripts from the computer system that is normally used to store the calls, and that this might be an abuse of the system, and it wasn't the only call where it happened.
You're doing well.
Thank you. A couple more details. After those documents were released, McGuire testified, which we will discuss. And then just as we went into the studio, the New York Times released a report that the whistleblower, according to their reporting, is a CIA officer with expertise in Ukrainian politics who had been assigned to the White House for some reason.
Yeah. Good job, Chad.
Anything else, guys?
No, that's a good summary. I mean, the complaint is secondhand, but basically says the president inappropriately used his position to further his own political ends by pressuring Ukraine to interfere in the election, by withholding military aid, and more than that, and we should get into that, but what the complaint really adds that we didn't know before was essentially an allegation of a cover-up, right? That's the big new thing in the complaint, I think.
Yeah. By the way, we should say that the things lined out in the whistleblower complaint have been at least preliminarily confirmed by other people with knowledge of it, and like the general fact pattern of the events has been confirmed. So the person who wrote up the report seems to perhaps be someone who, I mean, CIA analysts, their actual job is to write reports like this, typically about other places, but to essentially synthesize and summarize and provide intelligence.
And in the complaint, what's said about the call matches the summary of the call that was released, right, further corroborating perhaps at least the professionalism of the complaint itself.
Yeah, no, totally. And actually, like, so when the call summary first came out, I think all of us in the newsroom sort of increased our level of, like, how big this story could be, because we looked at it as, if this is the best case scenario for the White House, this is what they're releasing. At the least, this is Trump pressuring a foreign leader to intervene in a U.S. election, right?
Right.
I think what the whistleblower complaint adds is, like, an even higher level of how bad this could potentially be, because, one, it adds these allegations of a cover-up, and two, in that complaint, there's all these other people who knew about this stuff and had concerns about it. So that adds a lot of potential witnesses or people who can speak to this, but also a lot more stuff on the, and we can get into this, on the, if the White House was using military aid to pressure Ukraine, a lot more parts of that operation have come to light since the call summary came out. Does that make sense? In other words, it wasn't just Trump in passing on this phone call saying it. It appears like, or at least allegedly appears like, there were other efforts.
There was follow-up on the call.
There was follow-up.
From
right.
not just Rudy Giuliani, but from people within the administration. So there was, it was, yeah, it wasn't just idle talk that went nowhere. And we should say that, you know, someone like Bill Barr, the Attorney General, has come out and said, I was mentioned in this call, but I didn't do anything. But the memo does allege that other people in the administration followed up. So that's a big deal. And I think that they followed up on multiple occasions in a couple different countries. So it is, at least according to this memo, the allegations in the memo. So that's interesting. And a lot of fodder.
Did Republicans find it as interesting as we did?
Nope.
And so what was the general approach for Republicans in response to the transcripts? Well, I guess either or, because they haven't differed that much between the summary and the whistleblower's complaint.
So on the call summary, I think the general response was there's no evidence here of a quid pro quo, right? That was the line they wanted to draw.
And literally was the talking point, which the Trump administration emailed out to Democratic House members.
And then recalled, reportedly. Yeah.
Some low-level press staffer just had the worst day of their life.
Poor person. Recalling an email, anyway, so that was the line on the call summary. I think the line on the actual complaint, now that we have it, now that they have it, is still developing, I'd say. Look, for the most part, Republicans are still sticking by Trump. We've seen a few exceptions to that. But, you know, their line is mostly Democrats just want to impeach Trump and they're trying to find a way to do it.
Right. I think for the call summary that was released yesterday, it was certainly what we've been saying. Oh, Republican line was, he didn't explicitly say, the quid pro quo situation, right? The words were never spoken. Then today, during the hearing, and we can talk about that more in a second, but I think that Republicans on the committee, when they were, when they had the microphone, spent a lot of time talking about it's illegal to leak national security information. That's the real story. The media is aiding and abetting this. And so it was definitely sort of trying to be directed towards other elements of this.
The other big talking point among Republicans, I think, has been what you mentioned earlier, Chad, which is, as the complaint says itself, the whistleblower did not directly witness this stuff. And is more acting as a conduit. Good word. So, you know, that is, I think, potentially for right now for Republicans, an area of weakness in the impeachment pursuit. But
Democrats, you mean?
Yeah, I think right now that's potentially for Democrats an area of weakness in their impeachment inquiry. But like I said earlier, it could also be an area of strength if these other people come out of the woodwork, you know.
Let me add one more approach or strategy that Republicans have taken, which is to feign ignorance about what's in the call and what's in the complaint. Jennifer Habercorn, who is a congressional reporter for the Los Angeles Times, tweeted earlier today that 7 out of 7 GOP senators she spoke to said they have not read the whistleblower complaint at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And so, and with Congress going on recess, there is a sort of strategy for Republicans of let's wait and see how the next couple of weeks play out so I don't have to go on record. That might bite me either way in the end.
That's my favorite politician line. It's like, I haven't actually read it, but let me guarantee that someone on their staff has like summarized it for them or read it to them. But should we talk about the hearing?
We're going to do that right after this ad break, Claire. Great segue. Remarkable. And since this was a unplanned podcast before Galen went on vacation, through the magic of radio and time travel, Galen's going to read the ads.
Cool.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Legacy Box. We all have old home videos and photos that don't get much play in our digital world. VHS tapes, cassettes, or old rolls of film. Well, now you can get all of those easily digitized with Legacy Box. Become the family hero, bring back lost memories to watch and see again. All you have to do is send in your Legacy Box filled with old home movies and pictures. They'll do the rest, professionally digitizing your moments onto a thumb drive, digital download, or DVD. Over 450,000 families have trusted Legacy Box. They have over a decade of experience, and all the work is done by hand right here in the USA. There's never been a better time to digitally preserve your memories. Visit LegacyBox.com today to get started. Plus, for a limited time, they're offering 538 listeners an exclusive discount. Go to LegacyBox.com/538 to get 40% off your first order. That's LegacyBox.com/538, the numbers, not the letters, to save 40% off today. Get started preserving your past. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Quip. Simplify the morning and evening now with a simpler electronic toothbrush from Quip. The brush has sensitive sonic vibrations for an effective clean that's gentle on your sensitive gums. People brush too hard, and some electronic toothbrushes are too abrasive. Plus, the built-in 2-minute timer pulses every 30 seconds to remind you when to switch sides and help you clean your whole mouth evenly. Up to 90% of us don't brush for the full 2 minutes or don't clean evenly. Plus, brush heads are automatically delivered on a dentist-recommended schedule of every 3 months for just $5. That's why Quip is perfect for getting back into your fall routine. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/538 right now, you can get your first refill pack for free. That's your first refill pack for free at getquip, getquip.com/538, the numbers, not the letters.
Okay, we're back, and here to talk about the hearing of acting Director of National Intelligence Joseph McGuire.
Joe. You friends
Joe,
with him, Chad?
Me and Joe.
The most famous man in America.
Self-proclaimed.
Self-proclaimed.
That was my favorite part of the hearing, by the way. Yeah.
So, McGuire went, in front of the House Intelligence Committee on Thursday, and, it was sort of the first moment where we could really see the lines of inquiry from each party play out after the release of these documents. And interestingly, the hearing became more about the process of what McGuire did when
it's quite legalistic.
Yeah, when given the complaint and the Inspector General's assessment of the complaint. And so what was McGuire's rationale for what came next and what came next?
Go ahead.
So I just first want to make a note about McGuire and how interesting it is to have a person on the witness stand who is deeply uncomfortable with it and who obviously has very little experience with it, as McGuire did.
He wasn't next in line after Coates left the DNI. Someone else had to quit.
And he's been on the job for like six weeks. Yeah.
So McGuire was, I would say, he made kind of grimaces during people's opening statements. And I think in some ways watching him, I kind of felt for the guy because he sort of seemed to be in an awkward position. But here's the deal. McGuire kept on saying throughout the hearing that this was an unprecedented whistleblower complaint. Democrats continued to ask him throughout the course of, what, the 3.5 hours, why did you not immediately turn over this whistleblower to complaint to Congress, as every other whistleblower complaint from the intelligence community has been before?
And as the statutes suggest need to be.
Suggest. And he said, well, this was an unprecedented situation because it involved executive privilege.
It could involve
executive privilege. And basically he said that he had to go to the White House's Office of Legal Counsel to figure out whether or not he was allowed to turn it over, or whether it would be sort of breaching executive privilege. And then there was this other separate or connected yet separate discussion of whether or not it met the standards for,
urgent.
As he kept on saying that the urgency of the complaint was actually a statutory definition that had to do, you know, whatever. So he said, I wasn't sure if this actually fell under the legal definition of urgent, which Democrats had a lot to say about.
Right. So not all whistleblower complaints automatically go to Congress. Only ones that are deemed, what's the official language? It's like urgent something.
But again, both sides, McGuire and the Democrats, everyone was pointing out this is the first time it hasn't been turned over.
Something that did meet that threshold. Exactly. Right.
And I mean, one more thing on McGuire. I think as an overarching takeaway from the testimony, you saw this guy who McGuire is, you know, a person who talks to the president frequently. He said during his testimony, listen, I need to maintain a relationship with the president in order for him to trust me. And you saw him walking that line both in his testimony today and also in the description of his actions, the way he was sort of toggling between, wait, do I have a responsibility to turn this over to Congress? Do I have a responsibility to the White House? And there is some speculation that because of certain questions that McGuire just didn't answer, that he likely talked to the president about this whistleblower complaint.
So, yeah, a couple things on that. Democrats seemed to be following the pursuit or the potential of a cover-up from within the DNI for not giving the complaint and the Inspector General report to Congress. That essentially, perhaps Trump, to your point, Claire, may have said, don't give it over. The trick was that what McGuire was saying was that he was delaying things. His intention was never not to send it, but he wanted to see whether it fell under executive privilege. And then it got into the media, and then now it's out in the open. So what are we arguing about anyway? The House got what they wanted in the end.
Well, that's the thing, is like we had this big debate on the live blog about the kind of like political wisdom of Democrats' line of questioning, and the two sides were basically, why are they so focused on process? Why is this so legalistic? They should be hitting the substance of the complaint instead of exactly why and where the complaint didn't make its way to Congress, especially because the complaint didn't make its way to Congress. As Chad said, it didn't make its way as law dictates, but they have it now, right? And then the other side was, I think I was the only person on the other side, maybe. But was this just a debate in my head?
No, I disagree with you. Don't worry.
Okay. Yeah, the other side, my side was, most people won't watch this hearing, and I don't think it's fair to use it as a proxy for Democrats' overall impeachment message or plan. And so it makes sense when you have the Director of National Intelligence in front of you to focus on his part of this whole story, and then you can fold what you learn.
And he also, he also refused, even though asked in many different ways, to comment on the actual contents of the memo and whether or not he thought it was true. Now, at one point, a Democratic member asked him, in the abstract, if a president pressured a foreign country to interfere in the election, would that be a bad, illegal thing? And McGuire said, yes. So, I mean, I don't think there's any great mystery about whether or not McGuire thinks that this is a serious thing. It's just he was perhaps understandably obstinate about saying, I cannot comment on the veracity of this complaint or whether or not I think it's...
It's all very interesting. And this is going to be... I'm going to get out over my skis a little bit here. This is more impressionistic. But you do not get the sense of McGuire, especially because he's only been on the job for a month and a half, that he is like a Trump loyalist, just going above and beyond to protect Trump at all costs. What you actually get the sense is like he's new to the job. He is worried about protecting Trump to some extent, at least to the extent that anybody would be worried about their boss, right? And he's just trying to, as Chad said, go slow, feel things out. Now, in this case, it kind of got him into some trouble, but
yeah.
This to me gets at what Democrats have to do in this impeachment inquiry in order to convince anybody that it's anything but just a partisan charade. I've been ranting about this all week in our in-house channels, but I am not as convinced as people who just believe optimistically in like that American people really, you know, care about good governance and no corruption, for example, that Democrats are going to be able to connect what they say is misconduct of the Trump administration to something that is bad for more than a reason that they say it's bad. Like they can't just say this is bad, therefore Trump deserves impeachment. They have to convince Americans that there is a national security threat or that there is corruption or whatever else. And that's why I was harping today during the live blog on this idea of process versus substance, which is that Democrats with McGuire, aside from eventually sort of tiptoeing into that conversation, Claire, weren't hammering the director of national intelligence on whether or not, in his professional opinion, this kind of thing would be a national security threat. Because that's the key link to me.
Like when Mueller testified, I can't remember who asked him, but Mueller was a very reluctant witness, but someone asked him, what is the greatest threat right now that we face? And he almost lit up from within and said, it's election interference. And let me talk about election interference for 5 minutes. I don't think anyone, maybe McGuire by the end was just, I think he was a little bit wrung out by the experience by the end. I mean, it got pretty testy between Schiff and McGuire towards the end of the 3.5 hours. But no one necessarily gave him an opportunity and an open-ended question to say, how do you feel about election interference and how troublesome is it? Now, he did take a time to talk about how our greatest threat isn't kinetic warfare, which is a way of saying, like, killing people. It is cyber warfare.
And he mentioned election interference, right?
He did, but it wasn't like a no one really teed him up in the way that I remember Mueller being teed up to talk about this concern. And I do think, you know, to McGuire's particular situation, I was talking about this with someone, like career bureaucrats, people who value the advancement through the ranks, you know, obviously he was a longtime military person, but also you've spent your entire career maneuvering to this place and you become acting director because of, you know, the happenstance of this really tumultuous administration. I do think, I mean, it does mirror in some ways the Comey situation too in my mind, because it's almost this stuck in the middleness and this no clear answerness, because the executive branch, in this current case, is because it is uncharted territory. Like I do think that there is someone in the hearing said, well, there are lots of lawyers and lawyers disagree on what to do about this. So McGuire as the kind of befuddled bureaucrat is an interesting figure.
No, I think that's right. And I do think you saw daylight between him and the White House.
He didn't sort of take the bait when Republican lawmakers would say,
right,
we're so sorry that you're being blah, 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 blah. So like he saw what they were doing and he was kind of like, I am apolitical.
He tried to maintain that. I guess I just think, to zoom out again, this McGuire hearing, despite what he said, you know, no one's heard of this guy. A poll came out today from SurveyMonkey and Business Insider showing only a third of Americans have even heard about stuff about Ukraine so far.
But he's the most popular man in America.
He's the most famous
man. Sorry.
I just don't think that – I think we're going to look back and in the grand scheme of things, this hearing will be a footnote at best in the ordeal of this impeachment inquiry. And I think that the complaint, the details of the complaint, which came out today, that's amazing to remember, are really the thing here. They are the thing here to me.
So yes. Let's talk about what's to come next for this inquiry. It seems like because of the complaint, Democrats know pretty clearly who they are going to want to talk to in a congressional setting. Let's say you subpoena Rudy Giuliani. I cannot imagine that Rudy Giuliani is going to appear before Congress willingly, or that the administration will let him do so. And so are we headed just straight for an executive privilege fight that will go to the Supreme Court kind of thing?
I don't want to comment on the legal part of it, but we are going to have a big fight about who can testify, yeah.
And that's really about co-equal branches of government and whether Congress actually has subpoena power that's over the executive.
That's the super interesting part of all this, is the fight between the branches right now.
Well, but you would imagine they would testify not only Giuliani. Like, Giuliani in some ways is
I guess he's not part of the executive branch.
Yeah, in some ways he's like the
president's personal lawyer.
Right. But like Pompeo.
Pence.
The diplomats that are named in the complaint as following up with the Ukrainian officials.
Okay. So there are kind of two universes of people who you would follow up with. And they overlap, I'm sure. One is people involved in the care and feeding of the evidence surrounding the call with Ukraine and any other communication between Trump and Ukraine, right? And the complaint goes into some detail about how the White House took steps to treat this call as like uber national security classified secret, even though on substance it wasn't, because they were aware, according to the person who made the complaint, that it was an abuse of power, essentially. So there's that universe, the universe of people who are involved in handling the call and the call's artifacts, so to speak. There's also the universe of people that you just mentioned, Chad, that were involved in the actual logistics, to the extent they took place, of allegedly Trump using the military aid to pressure Ukraine to investigate Biden. And the complaint, as I said before, lays out a far more robust effort in that regard than I think we initially thought, or that I initially thought. So if it's that robust, it presumably involved a lot of people, which gives Democrats a ton of avenues to pursue.
And it might be bigger than Ukraine, whether or not the Democrats want to try and expand the inquiry. If the complaint, the whistleblower's complaint is accurate, that this kind of different lane for certain conversations existed within the White House for things where they didn't want the transcript or summary or whatever these were to get out, then that suggests there were other calls, maybe with other leaders. And I'm sure Democrats will at least start to pull at that thread.
No, the complaint says that, right? Yeah, it says there were – this is not the first time.
And my point is there are more people to subpoena or more people to try and call for a hearing.
But he's – I mean, this is like – Trump's in some trouble here.
So, yeah, let's step back. 48 hours ago, you guys were sitting here with Nate after Pelosi gave her speech. And I think at one point during that, I forget who said it, someone said the equivalent of like, this isn't actually that much of a change from what congressional Democrats had already been pursuing, because there were these inquiries into the Trump administration. 48 hours later, does that still hold for you guys?
Well, there were already committees that were sort of formed to be investigating the Trump administration. I think that those... from a purely logistical sense of like, who will be running this investigation? Like, who, like, are there staff members? There are probably people much more sort of queued up to pursue this. But I do think that the phone call, that the memo, that the potential testimony of the whistleblower are new, there are new facts. And, the Democrats are trying to just say that what is already public is enough for impeachment, right? The idea of abuse of power that we all have read about in that phone call is enough. Now we will hold these hearings to sort of bolster that claim, but we don't, like, they're trying to put out there, like, this is new. This is impeachable. Now we will, I don't know what to say, like, kind of gird up those, allegations.
No, yeah. And in a very, I think it was Nate who said, like, not much has changed. In a very, like, mechanical sense, that's true, I think. As Claire said, the kind of committees who were doing investigating are still going to be doing investigating. But it's kind of like, okay, you might be in the same car. Let's go back to our car metaphor from the previous show. You might be
it worked
in the same,
so well in the previous show.
You might be in the same. excuse me? You might be in the same car, but there's a difference between driving at 5 miles an hour and 100 miles an hour, right?
Not with me. I'm always in control. I'm an offensive driver.
That does not surprise me.
Are you an offensive driver?
Are you kidding? Could you imagine her like being cut off and not saying, how about, F you, buddy? I mean,
no,
I'm going to pull in front of you.
I'm a defensive driver. I drive very cautiously and safely.
You are. I do too.
You just said you're an offensive driver.
You can be a safe offensive driver. Okay, let's go.
Wait, I want to know what Chad is.
I drive like I'm a biker. So, like, sometimes it's aggressive in order to just sort of fend off all attackers, and sometimes, like, anything could kill me around any corner.
That's how, yeah, I drive, like, all the time. I'm terrified.
But keep that one
But that metaphor makes sense, right? Let me just get a gut check here. That's really the change here is now with Pelosi on board, the impeachment inquiry, such as it is, has gone into overdrive.
There's so much media attention now that it inevitably, it's a greenhouse effect, right? Like whatever was happening.
Mixing that metaphor.
It's a greenhouse effect in the car.
I am hijacking your car.
You're hotboxing the car.
I'm hotboxing the car. I'm taking it to the greenhouse. No, it's just because there is so much more attention. The sun is shining hotter on the committees, whatever. It is inevitably going to affect, what happens in the investigations, but how the people who are leading the investigations relate the narrative of what they're doing, how much closer like the scrutiny and the reporting is and all those things, how the White House people report on it. I do think it changes the tone entirely. You're right, Micah.
I get all that, but to extend the metaphor, the fuel in the car is way different now than it was before. Which is to say, leading into now, Democrats were investigating the Trump administration on more opaque, hard to understand scandals.
He's saying you're moving from 93 to premium.
Oh no, I agree with that. But that's beyond doubt. I mean,
right? I think for me though, what's changed isn't Democrats' interest in impeaching Trump. It's they actually now have the fuel they think to do it.
100%. 100%. But that, I don't think anyone was saying otherwise.
No one's actually in the public heard what happens when you and I disagree but say the same thing.
Listening, but I'm just sitting here like ping-ponging back and forth.
We all agree the fuel is much more supercharged now. We all agree the car is going faster. We disagree about whether it's being hotboxed and or driven to a greenhouse. Is that the state
of things? Yeah, that's an accurate summary. Good, Micah. You should host the podcast.
No, I begged off.
Okay, let's take one more step back and then we can bring this on home. Do we know anything in the last 48 hours about how the public is responding to the impeachment inquiry?
Yeah, so actually this is what I was going to add to that, to the last section of the conversation. Even if like mechanically the impeachment inquiry isn't that much different, the change in fuel, as Chad said, where it's now based on Ukraine, but more than that, the change in the Democratic stance on it, Claire was getting at this, at the very least, you would expect, today, before this Ukraine story really hit, impeachment not only like hasn't been popular among Republicans and independents, there was a big chunk of Democrats who weren't on board with impeachment, right? So in the wake of Ukraine, now that Democrats are sort of like the caucus is behind impeachment now, I think what we'll see and what we are already seeing in the very few polls we've gotten since the story broke is Democrats more unity on the Democratic side among elected officials and among voters behind impeachment, right? And so if that happens, let's say Democrats coalesce behind impeachment, then what you would expect is it'll get closer to at least the 50-50 issue in the country, right? And then, of course, you get into what do independents think, what do Republicans think.
And are Republican senators, for example, a good bellwether for Republican voters? Or is there a disconnect between that on an issue like this about the Trump presidency?
Well, I don't think we necessarily care about like the Republican base. I think we care about people who might have traditionally voted Republicans but are troubled by these allegations or
to quote Mitt Romney. That's what Mitt Romney says.
Sure.
That he's troubled.
No, and And yeah, so in that sense, I think there are Republican senators and members of the House who are a good proxy for
Susan Collins.
Right. For that more. And even if you go to the, like, Susan Collins is known as a moderate. Someone like our perpetual stand-in, Pat Toomey. I think he's a good stand-in, not for like the Trump diehard, but for like the more, a little bit more mainstream and a little bit more marginal Trump supporter, which is to say, like, it won't take Trump shooting someone on Fifth Avenue to get that person to distance themselves from Trump. It might take something really, really big, but this could be really, really big.
Let's leave it there. Thanks, Claire.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Thanks, Micah.
Thank you, Chad. It was a pleasure talking politics
with
you.
So fun. Usually I only talk about the Mets in this studio now.
Listen, wait. Let's plug your Mets podcast.
It's sort of moribund, just like the Mets. my name is Chadwick Matlin. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlow. You can get in touch with us by emailing us at podcast@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave a review in the podcast store of your choosing. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again on Monday.